We've climbed to the top of the world's highest peak. We've golfed on the moon and explored the deepest trenches of our oceans. But there's one frontier that we've just started to explore, the deepest cave on Earth. In his new book, Blind Descent, The Quest to Discover the Deepest Place on Earth, James Tabor tells the story of the men and women who set out to explore the super cave, placing them among the ranks of Edmund Hillary, Neil Armstrong, and Ernest Shackleton. The book is published by Random House. I'm very pleased that it brings James Tabor to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Now, the scientists in your book explore super caves. What makes something a super cave? Is Carlsbad a super cave?
Carlsbad is not a super cave. You know, as I was doing the research for the book, and I'm also a mountaineer, I knew that there were 14 8,000-meter peaks, which are these unique-sized mountains. There was no similar category or term to refer to these immense, vast, labyrinthine caves that go more than a mile beneath the surface. And there were only about a half a dozen of them. So I came up with the term super cave, and that's where it came from.
And you don't call these explorers or scientists spelunkers. Is that because spelunkers usually explore caves as a hobby?
That's exactly right. And among serious expeditionary cavers, as a matter of fact, spelunkers is kind of a pejorative. They almost see it as an epithet. So they have a saying. They say that cavers rescue spelunkers, which kind of, you know, connotes their amateurish. But spelunkers are indeed serious, good weekend cavers. These fellows who do the expeditionary work are scientists, and they're explorers on the level of Hillary and Amundsen.
So let's talk about the two men you focus on here, Bill Stone and Alexander Kimchuk. What are their scientific specialties?
Bill Stone has a PhD in structural engineering from the University of Texas.
Structural engineering? That doesn't sound very cave-like.
You wouldn't think so, but it's very interesting. I'll just take a little aside here. It enabled Bill to develop a piece of technology that really opened the way to super cave exploration. It's called a scuba rebreather, and his structural engineering was just invaluable in that. He's also done a lot of work for NASA, where his structural engineering came into play.
And that scuba rebreather is because when you go really into the deepest caves, you're in water?
There's a lot of diving involved in super cave exploration because, of course, water creates caves, and invariably you will encounter flooded tunnels or flooded passages. And what they found with caves that were 7,000 feet deep in the case of Krubera and more than 9 miles from the entrance to the terminus was there's only so many 40-pound scuba tanks you can carry down. So they needed a light, dependable source of scuba technology. And Bill Stone developed this rebreather, which is like the systems that submariners use to rebreathe their own air for months and months. A rebreather weighs about 40 pounds and will give a caver 8 to 12 hours of underwater dive time.
So
they can carry those with them all the way down into and out of these super caves.
What about Alexander Klimchuk?
He has a PhD in earth sciences, so his scientific discipline is more closely related to super caving. Hydrogeology is his specialist. He's a professor at the Institute of Kiev. Like Bill Stone, he became fascinated with caving early on and spent most of his adult life pursuing the quest for the deepest cave on Earth.
And they represent two caves that you write about here.
They do indeed. The caves, it's interesting, the men are very different, and the caves are as different as the men. Bill Stone's cave is Cheve in southern Mexico. Alexander Klimchuk's cave is Krubera in the Republic of Georgia, former Soviet Union.
And that may be the deepest cave in the world.
We believe that is the deepest cave. That's the Mount Everest of caves. One of Klimchuk's teams reached the bottom of Krubera, about 7,000 vertical feet, in 2004, and it appears that that has been confirmed as the deepest.
Although there may be other caves, we just haven't yet gone deep enough to find out. How do you even test it other than to go down?
It's a very good question. You know, just as certain geological conditions were required to form the Himalaya, where you had these tectonic plates coming up. Certain geological conditions are required for the formation of super caves. Two being you have to have miles of substrata that are limestone, water-soluble limestone, and you have to have enough precipitation on the surface to carve these things. Well, there's only about six places in the world where those conditions all exist. There's Mexico, the Republic of Georgia, and three others. The others clearly are not going to rival Krubera.
So this is the equivalent of the Grand Canyon. You need some water to go through a place, and over millennia, in fact, maybe millions of years, make a deeper and deeper hole.
That's exactly right. Water is the creator of all these giant caves.
So let's talk about Cheve in Mexico. When was it first discovered?
It was discovered in 1989 by a remarkable couple, Carol Vesely and Bill Farr, very serious expeditionary cavers themselves. And they had studied topographical maps of the region, and they thought, gosh, you know, there might be some good possibility for giant caves down here.
This is in southern Mexico. This is where the Mayans used to live.
Yes, that's exactly right. And a number
Did the Mayans use these caves?
They didn't use Cheve, but they have used other caves. And in fact, I shouldn't say they didn't use Cheve. They're not too far inside the entrance. There's a sacrificial altar where there is evidence that religious ceremonies and rites were performed. There's still bones of the victims that lay undisturbed there. It's an archaeological site.
And how deep does this cave go?
Cheve is about almost 5,000 vertical feet, and it's about 6 miles in length. Kruber, in comparison, is 7,000 vertical feet and about 9 miles in length.
But you enter them differently. Cheve is easier to get into because it's more horizontal, isn't it? Some of these caves, you got to go straight down.
The caves themselves are very, very different in character. Cheve is shaped like a giant L. So the first about 3,000 vertical feet are fairly vertical. It's almost like an elevator shaft. And then it levels out, and there's another 2 or 3 miles of about a 10-degree slant all the way down to the bottom. Krubera is like a giant elevator shaft. It's almost 7,000 feet straight down of just repeated vertical drops with some flooded passages in between.
They're very different. In other words, caves in general, I've only gone in a few caves. I've been to Carlsbad, mm-hmm. and I've been to to an ice cave in New Mexico, which seems stunning to me. The further you went in, the colder it got, and I didn't understand why, because it was desert above.
The ice caves are unique, but most of the solutional caves, as the ones are called that are formed by water, their internal temperature is a function of the average temperature at the surface. So Cheve, for example, is about 62 degrees air temperature and low 60s in the water temperature. Kruber is a freezing cave, 34 degrees air, 32-degree water temperature.
It's in the mountains?
It's in the mountains. So most of the water that flows in is glacial melt.
What is Cheve like when you first approach it from the outside? Does it have a big mouth?
It has a huge mouth. Carol Vesely and Bill Farr were running through this forest, and Carol said to Bill, gosh, wouldn't it be wonderful if we came around a corner and saw a grand Mexican? And she turned a corner, and there it was. It's preceded by a beautiful, level, green meadow they call a llano. And then you see this yawning cave. It's 100 feet wide. It's about 40 feet tall. And inside, it gets even bigger. So the entrance chamber in Cheve, you could park several 757 airliners. It's that big.
Often the local people, the indigenous people, don't like outsiders coming in and investigating these places. What's the situation in Cheve?
Yeah, that's true worldwide. In Cheve, there has been a significant amount of resistance from the indigenous people to cavers. They were concerned about two things. First of all, they thought the cavers were taking gold out of the caves. Well, there's no gold in the caves. But they also were worried about the religious implications. To them, these caves are as sacred as cathedrals are to us. One of Bill Stone's great achievements is he's fluent in Spanish and Mexican, and he's been able to create much better relations with the local indigenous people. So more recently, there have not been any serious incidents.
My guest is James M. Tabor. His book, Blind Descent, The Quest to Discover the Deepest Place on Earth. How do you avoid damaging the cave's environment? Wouldn't just breathing have a negative impact?
It's very difficult. I will say that cavers, the serious expeditionary cavers, feel about their caves the way that, and I'm a diver, that divers feel about coral reefs. They understand how precious they are. For example, if you touch a speleothem that's been millions of years in the making, the acid from your fingertips can kill that thing over a 1,000-year period. Serious cavers, as scientists especially, understand this, and so they take great, great pains to be as careful as they can, understanding that they are explorers and they have to leave some kind of human presence.
Now, Mexico has been having certain difficulties, but not in the area that you're discussing. On the other hand, the cave in Georgia is where there's been a fair amount of fighting, hasn't there?
It's been very difficult there. The region is called Abkhazia, and like South Ossetia, which your listeners may also know about, it's a very violent region. There's a lot of ethnic and separatist fighting been going on there. It's a very, very dangerous place, and for a while it was so dangerous that even the international teams led by Alexander could not get in there.
Now, in the past, I know in Alexander the Great's time, people actually used caves as places to escape to, and whole armies would sometimes be in caves, or they would actually build cities within the living rock. Do we see anything like that here?
We don't see that in either of these two particular caves, but the book does touch on the fact that caves throughout our history as humans have been extraordinarily important to our survival in a number of ways. Birthplace of religion, art, some think music, and as you say, have been used as habitation by great groups in times of peril.
And some of the greatest early art turns up in caves.
Absolutely.
I think France and Spain.
Yeah, absolutely. Many people are familiar with the great cave paintings in Lascaux. Not too long ago, they discovered earlier ones by even 10,000 years, which, fascinatingly enough, use techniques like perspective, which did not resurface until the Renaissance.
You write that when Buzz Aldrin learned about super caves, he said, "I thought there could be no environment as hostile as the lunar surface, no more."
That's correct. He has done some caving himself, and he has spoken with super cavers, and that was his assessment. And I think that really speaks to how extremely difficult super cave exploration is, given all of the multiple challenges.
Well, is it as dangerous as climbing Everest?
I haven't climbed Everest. I've climbed some big mountains in Alaska, and I've also done some serious caving. My estimation is that it's more dangerous because there's the darkness, the absolute eternal darkness. There's the diving. There's the vertical work required, but it's always in the dark, and there's some other variations.
And I noticed that you introduced both caves by describing a fatality and a near fatality that occurred when they were being explored.
Yeah, that's true. There were, unfortunately, four fatalities associated with exploration of both of these caves. Three were diving, and one was a fall fatality. And although there are, I think, 50 ways to dive to die in a cave, those falls and water drowning are probably the most common.
And the bodies are rarely brought back because it's so difficult?
It depends on how deep they are. In the case of the fall fatality, they were able to retrieve that body, but it took them a year.
A listener wonders if the Georgian people take any special pride in their cave. Is it a part of their culture or lore?
That's a great question because it goes to the point that in Europe and Eastern Europe, cave exploration is much more a mainstream activity than it is here in the United States. Children start caving as early as four. So they take very great pride in the fact that they have the cave and they have the people who accomplished it.
That listener also wonders if there are molds or spores that can make the explorers sick in these depths.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. One of the other dangers in these great caves are microbes that live in them, histoplasmosis being one example. That infected a caver in one of the Eastern European caves, and he very nearly died from it, only weeks in the hospital, and many antibiotics saved his life. But those microbial presences are very much a danger.
And you talk about the rapture.
Yeah, that's people who.
It's not a religious thing.
No, it's not a religious thing, and it's not like the rapture of the deep. It's just the opposite of euphoria. It's been described as being like a panic attack on meth. It's a response to repeated days and days and days at depth in the darkness. And every human psyche apparently has a limit beyond which it just can't stand. An absolute panic, and it can strike experienced cavers, it can strike anyone at any time, like altitude sickness very much.
So when you say darkness, you're talking about complete darkness? Aren't they carrying lamps?
Cavers do have multiple supplies of lamps. That's absolutely essential. But for extended stays underground, when you're not moving or performing a task, you turn your lights off in order to conserve your power. So the vast majority of time you're underground, you're literally in the dark.
Why does Bill Stone adamantly reject describing super cave exploration as adventure?
I think because he's a scientist.
Is that Indiana Jones thing? I'm sure that he's been introduced more than once as a modern-day Indiana Jones.
He absolutely has. And, I think there's probably a secret part of him that enjoys that label. But he also – his identity is totally tied up in being a serious scientist and explorer.
Now, but people do climb Mount Everest mostly for the adventure because it's there. If he's a scientist and going into these super caves, he must be going for another reason. Is there much to be learned from them?
There's a great deal to be learned from them. There are undeniable scientific benefits. I will just say about Bill that, you know, if you asked him about the adventure, of course, he says no, but he loves excitement and thrill and challenge as much as anyone. But some of the science that's coming out of these great caves is a new family of antibiotics, for one, that will prove to be, are proving to be effective against these drug-resistant bacteria we have. We're learning an awful lot about aquifers, the great subterranean water sources that are so important to our survival. And NASA, it turns out, is very interested in the stressors that attack these teams underground for months because they're like the what's going to happen to their Mars crews.
Well, we hear all about people who've climbed Everest or other great mountains, but cave exploration is rarely reported on. We have images of the first steps on the moon, mountaineers making their final steps to the summit. Why don't we have similar images in these for these cave explorers?
That's such a wonderful question, and it's one of the reasons I really wanted to write the book. You can see mountains, you can see the ocean, see the moon. Caves, you can't see, and so they've remained kind of out of sight, out of mind in the collective consciousness. And until fairly recently, we didn't have the technology that allowed us to bring moving and still pictures from the very deepest parts of these great super caves. Now we have both. And I hope that, that my book will help these folks get some of the recognition they really, really deserve.
In researching the book, how far did you go into any caves?
These expeditions were finished in 2004, and I didn't learn about them until 2007, which actually says something about how little heralded they were. I've been below 1,000 feet in a number of caves. I've done a lot of serious caving in the United States and Canada.
Did they look all different? I've been to Carlsbad, as I'm sure many listeners have. Is that a typical cave?
I would say it is a typical cave in the sense that it's a solutional cave. There's beautiful colors in the walls.
There's stalagmites and stalactites.
Exactly. It's an unbelievable, unearthly speleothems and things. It's another world. And having said that, each cave does have its own unique personality.
And Carlsbad, of course, has lighting, which is something that you don't get in these other places.
That's exactly right.
James M. Tabor is the author of Blind Descent, The Quest to Discover the Deepest Place on Earth. It's his latest book. It's published by Random House. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a fascinating discussion. Are you going to do any caving in the future, or are you going to go back to climbing mountains?
I'm going to do some of both, and my hope is to get into one or both of these super caves. If the opportunity arrives, I will certainly go there. And I want to thank you for the chance to be here. It's been an honor, Leonard.